Turning to 1 Samuel once again, as we look at the life of David, this time we come to another chapter, the 25th chapter. It's a long chapter, and I'll read every word, and I just ask if you would follow along and listen as I read, and then we'll explore the text a little more. So again, this is 1 Samuel, it's chapter 25. The text begins, "Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. And the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, 'Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David.' When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?' So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, 'Every man strap on his sword.' And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 men remained with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, 'Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet your master, or greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm. We did not miss anything when we were in the fields as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by day and by night, while all the while we were with them, keeping the sheep. Now therefore know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him.' Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared, and 5 seahs of parched grain, and 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, 'Go on before me. Behold, I come after you.' But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under the cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, 'Surely in vain I have guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him.' When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal in his name and folly is with him. Is his name and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. For the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And even shall not be found in you, and evil shall not be found in you, so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation for himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant." And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you have hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal as much as one male." Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things. And his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from wrongdoings. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her 5 young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. This, my friends, is the word of our God. So as we explore this narrative tonight, I want to do so by looking at the three main characters of the story, the human characters that predominate the story. And hopefully as we do that, we also will be able to sort of transport the truth learned from their stories into our own lives. But before we do that, let me also comment on the one other human mentioned in the story, the one who is named by name, who is only named in passing at the very beginning when we're told of him in this chapter, is that he has indeed died. Before we ever hear of Nabal and Abigail and David, we first read of Samuel. We read that Samuel died and that all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Now, there's not much I can add to what's said there, only the observation that it was all Israel that assembled and mourned. And that reflects the prominence of this man Samuel in his day, this prophet of Israel. The beginning of 1 Samuel, which really we didn't look at it in this sermon series because we're focusing on the life of David, really informs us more about the life of Samuel and why he held such a prominent place. But even then, we learn that Samuel was very old at the very beginning, and now we learn of his death, and his death even before we ever reach the end of the first book of Samuel, and there's a second book yet to come. That reflects to us that although these are books that bear his name, he's not really the author. The author of the book is not mentioned throughout all the texts. But it's also really rather obvious that we are being directed by whoever the author is to these three other people who are named, not as much to Samuel now. And that brings us to the first one named, who is Nabal. It's not an uncommon practice in our own day when one of us might be seeking to name a child who has been born into our family to look for a suitable name that we might want to choose from the Bible. I don't recommend that any of you ever choose this name, Nabal. What we learn about him from the text is that he was a harsh man, a badly behaved man. We learn that he was a worthless man. Despite all his wealth, he was a worthless man. And then to top all of that off, although the text really doesn't reveal this directly, the Hebrew word Nabal means fool. Nabal's name suited him. But I hope that doesn't become a common name for our own children. In spite of the fact that the man bears the name that means fool, and despite the fact that he was a brute and a worthless man, that doesn't mean that he wasn't also a man of some wealth and some status. In fact, that's related to us before we ever learn his name. Nabal has flocks of sheep and goats, and he employs shepherds. We learn at the outset that he was actually a very, very rich man. The number of his flocks is really rather astounding. He possessed 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. The ability to establish such an ongoing enterprise is in the eyes of many an indication of some wisdom. But here it is very plain that such a supposition is never necessarily true. Nabal shows forth his foolishness in this story. And the way that happens is by his denying David the request for some sheep for food at the time of the shearing, which would have been a time of feasting, a time of festival. David, remember, was a man on the run with his 600 soldiers, an army of fighting men to fight well. They need to be fed. They need to be an army of fed warriors. And the stealing of sheep to satisfy hunger was really a rather commonplace thing to do in those days. Well, Nabal had these animals all ripe for the picking, but neither David nor any of his men had taken any advantage of Nabal's vulnerability. In fact, Nabal had lost none of his flocks, as David and his men had unasked become the protectors of Nabal's land, of all that Nabal had. David had guarded all that this fellow Nabal had in the wilderness so that nothing was ever missed from all that belonged to him. Well, now once it gets to this festival time, that's when David asks for the meat for food from Nabal's flocks. Now, it's true that Nabal doesn't seem to have asked for the protection David had given. But still, the generous thing for Nabal to have done was to still bless his benefactor. But Nabal, of course, is the foolish man, the one who is harsh, the one who is badly behaved, the one who is worthless. And so not only does he reject David's request, but he does it with insults. Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Now, David was a known man. Women had been singing about him. The knowledge of his military victories was widespread. Surely the story of his defeat of Goliath was known throughout the land. Nabal acted as if ignorant, even though his wife Abigail seems to know so much about David and who he is. Nabal simply has no grace. He shows no honor to the one who will be his king. He instead responds as a fool often would, with insults. Nabal is the fool. He has no generosity. He hasn't understood the blessing of God David has been to him. And he so loves his own possessions that he won't provide his future king even when he sees that his king, David, is one who is in need. And you know something? There's many Nabal types still living with us in our world today. So many people who hold tight to earthly wealth that has no lasting heavenly value, when they could instead be so generous with what is theirs without ever, really ever feeling any pain of loss. But then there's Abigail, where Nabal is the fool, his wife is a woman of wisdom. She becomes the great contrast to her own husband. But before I say any more about her, let's turn instead and let's look at David a little bit in this story. Now, we know an awful lot about David already. But what we see here is that he, David, is far, far, far from being a perfect man. We can read of this story and we can presume David to be right in asking Nabal for generosity. And Nabal is actually wrong for refusing. But we also see David as a rash and vengeful man once that generosity is refused. David had no right to demand Nabal give up what was Nabal's. And he certainly had no right to take vengeance against Nabal for any of Nabal's perceived wrongs to him. Vengeance belongs to God. It's interesting, I think, how in verse 13, once David learns of how Nabal has refused David meat from his flocks, that David immediately says to all of his men, every man strap on his sword. Every man of there strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. I kind of think that the author of the book repeats the words about strapping on swords because he really doesn't want us to miss the fact that the swords are being summoned by David. And David makes clear much later in the chapter that his intent was not to leave so much as one male alive in the house of Nabal. Now, David's intent is changed, of course. He changes his intent once he has this encounter with Abigail, and once she speaks of how David's proposed slaughter would be something that would bring blood guilt upon his own hand. And David acknowledges that himself. He says it with his own words, too. He eventually will see he was wrong to take vengeance into his own hands against Nabal, and that instead he should leave that vengeance to God. But please don't miss the fact that his first thought was to slaughter many because of his own pride. And I think we see once more that that is meant to draw our attention to the sinfulness of David. And then we also see that sinfulness arise again when at the end of the story, once Nabal is dead, God's in opposition to what I would say is God's will, David then takes Abigail to be his wife. Remember, already David has a wife, Michal, the daughter of King Saul. The author of this letter tells us that Saul had by this time given that daughter, David's wife, to another man to be married. But before we ever even can start wondering if it's all right for David to remarry in light of those facts, the author adds to the story that David also took another wife, Ahinoam. It would seem, as the story ends, that we are being drawn to see this act of polygamy. And so we also see that David is sinful because he is inclined to become a man accommodating the cultural wrongs surrounding him. Polygamy was also something common among the nations, and now it's being seen as well as an acceptable thing in the man who would be Israel's king. And I think that too really does also invite comparisons to our own day. Not because we have now become a people who accept polygamy. We still haven't, at least not yet. But there is always a pressure within the modern church to conform with the surrounding culture. And sometimes the church, in fact, does cave in. And David seems to have done that here and shows us the wrong of that. Well, if Nabal is a foolish, sinful man, and David is sinful, though maybe not so foolish, well, Abigail then becomes the contrast to both. Unlike the name Nabal, Abigail is really a more acceptable biblical name for our daughters. And maybe that's because Abigail here is presented to us as such a wise woman and a woman of courage. She risked her own life to see that mercy would be bestowed upon others. It's clear also that without her intervention, it would seem as if Nabal's whole house would likely be slain, and then David would be guilty to have blood on his hands, the blood of many. Abigail learns through one of Nabal's own young shepherds of how Nabal had responded to the request for food that came from David's men on David's behalf. She also learned that David really had protected the shepherds of Nabal. David's men were very good to them, and they were while they were with him, they suffered no harm, and when in the fields, all that was Nabal's remained Nabal's. David and his men were like a wall of protection. That's what this servant says. Day and night, a wall of protection. In other words, they protected all the time. And this wife's servant also knew that Nabal, the fool, wouldn't listen to him, and that's why he went to Nabal's wife. Well, then Abigail, once she receives all this information, is a woman of action. She takes 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, 5 seahs of grain, of parched grain, and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs. She lays it all on donkeys. She sends young men ahead of her with the provisions to go to David, perhaps just in case she might not get there in time. And once she is in the presence of David, she shows him the respect that her husband had him. She calls him her Lord, who has favor with the Lord, Yahweh. She refers to him as nobility. He will become the Prince of Israel. And she asks forgiveness on behalf of her foolish and rash husband. She has courage, she has wisdom, and she demonstrates her trust in God. And again, we see her in this story as one who has a role in preventing the blood guilt of David 4 times. In verses 26, 33, 34, and 39, we find in those verses that although Abigail is the one requesting the mercy, it is really God who is acting through her to prevent David's rash attitude from becoming deadly and vengeful and blood guilt. Last Sunday night, when we were looking at the prior chapter, I spoke of the presence of God's providence in that chapter, in the events of that chapter. I also said that we shouldn't presume we know exactly how God has worked in whatever his providence brings about. Sometimes I suggested we're wise in simply waiting on the providential hand of God. And in tonight's text, we see the providence of God present once again. Providence brought about through God's instrument of this godly woman, and it's a providence of God that is preventative in nature. God's hand intervenes to prevent sinfulness, particularly David's sinfulness. My friends, I don't know about you, but I think I've known that type of providence of God. Again, I issue that warning that I did last week that we are wise not to always be presuming we exactly know how God is providentially working, even as we know He's always working. But there was a time in my younger days when my moral compass was certainly not inclined very much at all to follow the moral commands that have been revealed by God. But still, the opportunities that could have come for me to do the sins I might have been inclined to do did not routinely manifest themselves. God's hand might well have been keeping me from doing evil, even as I was unaware of His ever-present hand. And I think that's one truth we can certainly take away from this text tonight. Sometimes the providential work of God keeps us from the evil we might otherwise commit. Sometimes His providence even works that way in people who have rejected God. God restrains evil at times from being as bad as it could be. And I think we do well to take that lesson from out of the chapter of David's life and into our own lives as we depart from here tonight. We should constantly, constantly be thankful that God often restrains evil in others and evil in ourselves. I also think there are a couple of aspects of this passage that point the readers of David's time forward to see Christ. They highlight for us true things about Jesus. I've mentioned at times in the past that when we read the Davidic narratives that David oftentimes foreshadows his greater son Jesus. That happens when we read about him. We don't see that really so much tonight, because there is a greater focus on the sin of David. But where I think we do get a small glimpse of Jesus in David is in that first interaction with David's men on behalf of David that they have with Nabal. David is asking Nabal, in a sense, to treat him as a king. Abigail calls David her lord, and David would have liked Nabal to do the same sort of thing when David, as king and protector, asked Nabal for his services. Nabal responded to David in the way many people in this age respond to Jesus. When God demands human allegiance to him by his people, their Lord and King, they deny the King of Kings and instead seek their happiness in their own material belongings, rather than storing up treasure in heaven. There is a sense in this small way, in that interaction between David and Nabal, that informs us of how we should all be responding to Jesus Christ. But then I also think we see something of Christ, not in David, but in Abigail. Isn't it amazing to see her in verses 23 and 24 intervene on behalf of her sinful husband? She falls down before David on her face. She bows down to the ground and she says, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt." She has done nothing wrong in the story, yet she asks another's guilt be placed upon her. Now, doesn't that remind you of Jesus? That's what the Savior does. He intervenes for sinners. And he says to God the Father, "May their guilt be on me." So see in this story of Nabal, David, and Abigail, the way God does sometimes work his providence, the way he has providently worked salvation by one more righteous than another bearing this guilt of sinners. And rejoice that your Lord and your King really is one who is perfectly righteous and has borne your guilt upon himself at the cross. This is a narrative story from the pages of the Bible. It tells us about these three people. but it's also telling us something about God, something about Christ, something about ourselves. We need one like him to intervene for us, to be the guilt bearer of our shame and our sin, so that we might become the righteousness of God. Let's turn to the Lord in prayer.